Hey everybody, before we get started, I just wanted to jump on because we are so excited to announce that Restore registration is officially open. We can't wait to be with you again this year. It's going to be on September 5th through 7th at the Mountain America Expo Center in Sandy, Utah. That's the evening of September 5th and then all day on the 6th and the 7th. 3 days of incredible speakers, poets, musicians, and artists. We really think that what we have planned will blow you away again this year, so you won't want to miss it. Go to faithmatters.org/restore for tickets and we'll see you there. Hey everybody, this is Aubrey Chavez from Faith Matters. As Holy Week and Easter Sunday approach, we thought that it would be really helpful to visit with someone who could help us to reflect on these sacred events in a new way. Our guest today, Dr. Carrie Muehlstein, recently wrote The Easter Connection, which dives into the biblical account of Holy Week and illuminates the theme of eternal unification. In this short book, you can read it in just one sitting, Carrie explores the various ways Jesus' final week teaches us about disconnection and the idea that through the atonement of Jesus Christ, we can overcome the separation that seems to be at the heart of our suffering. One of the things we appreciated about this conversation with Carrie is that while his analysis offers a fresh understanding of the atonement, he also leaves space for the mystery of the atonement and the ways that it surpasses our understanding. Holy Week is a time for contemplation of sitting with the story of Jesus' atonement and death on the cross and letting it transform us. And while we always hope for new insights that increase our understanding, the magnitude of what we can't comprehend about the story is part of what keeps us coming back to the story again and again. We appreciate Carrie drawing us to the beauty of the mystery in the atonement. And we also appreciated the practical takeaways from Carrie's book. When we see human suffering and sin as a product of separation and disconnection, it's easier to be merciful with people's flaws and mistakes, not to mention our own. Carrie helps us to see how love and unity are always what we are seeking, deep down. Carrie's book, The Easter Connection, is at Siegel, Desert Book, and Amazon. We really hope you enjoyed this conversation.
All right. Well, Carrie, thank you so much for being with us. It's a delight to have you here.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. We loved this little booklet, The Easter Connection. Thank you for writing it and sharing your insights. I want to share, and I should tell our listeners, before we started recording, we discovered that we grew up in the same place. We now live very close to each other. Our lives have followed very parallel paths.
It does make me worried for you.
one other thing that we have in common, I love Relative Race.
Oh, all right.
The show. I absolutely love it.
And it is the best.
It is the best. Yeah. And you framed this book around Relative Race. And so I felt a kinship as soon as I read that. Maybe that's a place to start. Yeah. Would you mind sharing sort of what it is that you love about Relative Race and how it connects to what we're going to talk about here?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And I have a podcast called The Scriptures Are Real, where I've actually interviewed Dan Debenham about this book and his connection and heard some of his connection. And it's just becoming more beautiful and powerful for me.
Amazing.
So Dan is the host of this show. Where if people aren't familiar with it, people who don't know who their family are, their biological family, a lot of times it's people who have been adopted. Not always. You get a lot of people who've been through the kind of system, right? They've been in foster care or something like that, and they've never really had family, but they don't know who their biological family are, and they want to. There's this loss of connection that they feel. And so they submit DNA, and Relative Race matches them up and helps them. And they do it in a race format, but they help them find their family. And often you see these people who they have this deep wound and they are wondering, why was I, often they've been put up for adoption, but as I said, sometimes taken to the system, but why was I left by my family? Did they not want me? Have I been rejected? This sense of abandonment that affects how they see themselves. And they're just looking for healing and being made whole and finding out who they really are, and a lot of elements along those lines, right? There's some pain associated with this. And to me, it's just incredibly moving again and again and again. And I used to not be this way. Now I cry at like almost everything. Yep. I remember Elder Holland saying, you know, I'm known to cry at a good grocery store opening, but I'm starting to get that way. But I think it's largely because of Relative Race. I cry every time I watch that show, just the wholeness that comes. And then the hero, a lot of times it's, I didn't even know about you, or I've been looking for you, or something along those lines. And the healing that happens and the wholeness that happens because of that. And as I said in the book, it's kind of the premise that gets me started. Well, there are two premises and we can talk about the other one in a minute if you want. But part of it is I realized, like, every time I watched that, I felt myself being made whole. And I had to ask myself, I've been raised in a very close family, just loving, warm, wonderful environment that I'm very grateful for. But I thought, how can I be healed? I wasn't wounded. And I came to the determination I must be wounded in some way. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that we all carry a really deep and primal wound, whether we realize it or not. And that is that we had heavenly parents. However close we are or are not to our parents here, it can't be as close as we were to our heavenly parents. And we've been separated from those parents. And whether our, well, we have a veil. Our conscious mind doesn't remember that, but our soul does. And we feel this yearning and this longing for that connection. Even atheists feel it, whether they know what it is or not. There's a longing for that connection. And that's part of what, well, that's the major role of Christ. And the reason he was sent is to heal that gap, to seal the gap, to end the rupture, to bring us back and make it so we can be not only reunited with our heavenly parents, but to be in an even higher, closer communion with them. And recognizing that kind of started me out on this path of exploring that element of the Easter story.
Yeah. Yeah. So you tell the Easter story, this story that's very familiar, but kind of through this lens of separation and reunion and separation and reunion. And you see, you mark all of these times where this happens in the last week of Christ's life. So do you want to talk about the other premise before we jump into the Easter story?
Yeah, it's all right. Maybe.
Yeah, yeah, just, go ahead.
Because, mm-hmm. And I think this is part of why I saw it in the relative race. I've been studying and researching, well, a lot of things, but especially the covenant or the Abrahamic covenant, mm-hmm. new and everlasting covenant for more than a decade now. And writing about it and so on. And through that, I came to realize that the central component of that covenant is relationship with God, relationship with others also, but especially relationship with God. And so that's part of what helped me see this connection with relative race, but it's part of what made me also think is I thought, okay, we were at last general conference, April 2023, Elder Stevenson and others were telling us we should take Easter more seriously. And I've always felt that and believe that. And we do our own little mini celebrations of Holy Week, and we have a Palm Sunday walk that we invite people to and all that kind of a thing. And I thought, well, how can I help others with this? And I thought, you know, I think it's time to take this covenant lens, and especially that particular element of the lens, the connection or relationship with God, and apply it not only to looking at Christ's atoning sacrifice, but to the whole Easter story, which came, I've come to be convinced that actually the whole Easter story is his atoning sacrifice. It's not just mm-hmm. Gethsemane or even Gethsemane on the cross. It's from the Last Supper through the resurrection as part of his atoning sacrifice, I now believe. But as we apply that lens of the need for a higher, holier, more unified relationship with God, and then we take in that element of the rupturing that we experienced that I got from relative race, and I put those two together, and it really did open up a lot of elements in that Easter story that once I looked at it that way, I thought, how did I miss this before?
Yeah.
This is what the whole story is about, and somehow I missed it.
Yeah. How did you used to see covenant? If this is kind of a new revelation, how would you have described the way you looked at covenant before?
So that's an interesting question as well. I saw it as God's trying to change us and exalt us and bless us and the relationship in which we could do that. But it really was I'd been teaching about the Abrahamic covenant since I first started teaching Old Testament at BYU in 1994, mm-hmm. and had this nice bullet point list. But when I was writing a book, I wrote a book called God Will Prevail that's about this covenant. And when I was writing that, I thought, I can't just put the bullet point list mm-hmm. of blessings and obligations in there. I need to arrange them somehow. And as I tried to arrange them and say, this part goes with this part and it leads to this part. And as I arranged them, it just came together where suddenly I saw, oh, there's one guiding principle that everything else flows from. When that principle is at the top, then that leads to this and this, and it all works and it all flows. And it became very clear to me it was about relationship with God. And as I wrote and taught that, I know President Nelson was talking about it a little bit as well. And then he kind of interacted with some of my teachings and so on. And he was teaching, I was teaching. We both started teaching it more as we and our teachings interacted and so on. It's become, I think, a really important element for all of us to understand.
Yeah. I think sometimes the way we view church teachings or commandments or covenants and ordinances can be in sort of a transactional nature at times.
Yeah, like that's the problem.
Yeah, I'm going to do this, and therefore God is going to do this. Would you say that this, I guess, this study of the way that you're now understanding both covenant and Christ's atonement has changed that for you?
Absolutely. And when we see this not as the atonement, the plan of salvation, and everything, from that relational lens, it it answers a lot of questions and solves a lot of little riddles and dilemmas. So just as an example, I was just talking with Gaina Lynn Condi, who I just respect so much. And she was on my podcast and we were talking about this verse. We're saved by grace after all we can do. And she started to talk about, well, if you look at this from a transactional point of view and different points of view, then you can take this a lot of different ways. But when you look at it a relational way, it changes the way you take that verse and the way that you think about what you can do about Christ and grace, and you put it in terms of a relation, right? Or Jennet Erickson has been talking about in a fantastic devotional at BYU and elsewhere, have been talking about, okay, we are relational beings and the covenant is about that. And I think that I can't think of almost anything in the gospel or other elements of life that haven't been affected for me, at least. And as I talk with others and they catch this vision, that's affected for them as well, that where we start to see this is about God wanting us to have the kind of joy that can only happen when we have full, complete union and communion with Him, right? So think about your greatest joys. Doesn't it come from loving relationships? Yeah. And the greatest joy we can experience is when we have a full, complete, unified, loving relationship with our heavenly parents.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, like, the deepest pain probably is separation because of all that love. And I think that's kind of where you begin with the last week of Jesus's life, this experience of being separated and then coming back again. So do you want to jump in? Just jump into that week? Would you walk us through where you first see this theme of separation coming up in Christ's life?
Yeah, it's interesting. As I looked at it, I saw these parallel tracks that Christ is there to talk to them about what he's about to do, which is to create the opportunity for full union and communion. And yet, in order for that to happen, he's going to have to experience full aloneness, separation, rejection, and abandonment, right? Mm-hmm. And in fact, I wish that I would even add a couple things to the book, although it's already longer than they wanted it to be in, so we'd see. But anyway, I'd add a couple more because I understand it even a little bit better. Not really a whole lot, but a little bit better after we've just done our Come Follow Me study of 2 Nephi 2 and looking more at it and, you know, having that lens on as I was looking at opposition in all things. And I think I've come to understand that if we have misery and joy, you know, sweet and bitter on opposite ends, then we have communion and aloneness on opposite ends. Or unity, that Zion, or being of one heart and one mind on one end, then aloneness is on the other end. And so if Christ is going to propel us to complete and full union, then the push the opposite direction that he had to experience was full, complete aloneness, rejection, and abandonment. And so I start to see that immediately as the Last Supper starts, and you see him starting to talk about unification. But for every time he's saying something about unification, he's either saying or experiencing something that is about his being alone. So he'll say, it's wonderful to be with all of them. Oh, but one of you is going to betray me, right? or he'll start to talk about wanting to be one with them and they have to have part in him and he can abide in them. But you're actually going to scatter from me in a little while. Mm-hmm. And then Peter says, I'll never leave. And he says, Peter, you're going to deny me. And then, and to me, this is maybe the most heartbreaking part of all of it. Just after he tells Peter, you know, you're going to deny me and you'll all scatter from me. He says, but it's okay. I'm never alone. I'm always with my Father, which is this haunting, haunting foreboding of his finding himself alone, not expecting it. He just said, I won't be alone. And then at the end, he finds himself alone. I'm almost emotional just thinking about that reversal that even Christ experiences. Yeah. But you just, if you go through and see, you see teaching about unity. Oh, but I'm going to be alone. Here's how I'm going to make it unified. Oh, but I'm going to be alone. And you just see him just hurtling down this path of aloneness and rejection. That's both so touching and so heartrending at the same time.
Yeah. Wow.
Why do you think that had to be part of the story? Like, is it just because of the opposition, like you said, or what was it that was so necessary, that made that so necessary? Why couldn't we learn about it by him, you know, another Sermon on the Mount that talked about union and being together?
I think it's not just about learning. I think it's about his ability to enact and effect a change in us. And I have to say, I mean, I don't claim to fully understand the atoning sacrifice. So I can't fully explain why his suffering for my sins makes it so that I don't. But I know that that's what happens. I don't know why his suffering for my sorrows and my pains and travails that we learn about in the Book of Mormon, that he suffers for those things. I don't know why that makes it so he can empathize with me and relieve me of that, but it does somehow. And so along those same principles, there must be something to this, the degree of unity he wanted to provide us as a gift. It's something we couldn't do, right? So it's something, whatever he is gifting to us, he has to pay the price on the opposite mm-hmm. end. So if he's, as much as he wants to gift that unity to us, then the price is the opposite of that unity. And it's a price he was willing to pay, which is incomprehensible to me and fills me with so much gratitude.
Yeah. The question that's coming up for me is, well, you mentioned that he didn't realize how alone he would be at the end.
That seems to be the case.
It does. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially because of what he says right there in the Last Supper.
Yeah. And his cry on the cross, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why hast thou forsaken me?
Yeah.
Right? I'm curious. What's coming up for me is, how much of this entire episode did you think was unexpected to Christ? Did he understand as you've studied this, I'm not asking you to declare a doctrine right. here, by any means, but in terms of speculation, yeah. Like, did the suffering in the garden seem unexpected? Did the crucifixion itself seem unexpected?
Yes and no, I would say. So, I mean, there are a number of things we have to wrestle with here. One of them, he clearly knows he's going to suffer in Gethsemane. He clearly knows he's going to die on the cross. And we also have to recognize that we're talking about a divine being who, knows all things. And yet there's something we have to wrestle with there, that Christ as Jehovah transcends time, transcends everything. And so he knows and understands and comprehends all things. And yet his mortal experience, which he's doing partially so we can do these sufferings, partially so we can emulate him and he can understand what we're going through. He seems to experience that mortal experience in very much the same way we do. So it would seem that there are, I mean, we learn in section 93, he's progressing grace for grace and so on. So that divine being is also having a mortal experience where he progresses like we do. He just does it more quickly than we do. And so it seems to me, and I really don't know, right? These are things I'm wrestling with in my mind and trying to figure out. But it seems to me that as Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden could say, all right, I'm choosing to experience pain and suffering, yet they don't have any idea what that means. Mm-hmm. Christ says, I know I will suffer, but he doesn't know what that depth is, so that he'll say things like in the Doctrine and Covenants, it makes even I, the greatest of all, to shrink and would that I might not drink the bitter cup, right? So when you look, and I do this a little bit in the book, when you look at those phrases that describe him in the garden, and they really mean like there's a terrified surprise and a deep, dark depression. That suggests to me that this was worse than he thought it would be, to the point where he asks, and I'll paraphrase, because what he really asks is, you know, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. But the way I read that is he's saying, this is so terrible. If there's any other way, I'd like to do this a different way. I don't want to do this if I can avoid doing this.
Yeah. So do you think also we can be, If Christ in this week is learning quickly, like should this also be teaching us how we can handle our own separation throughout life? Like I'm thinking specifically of when he's in the garden and he asks for those who are closest to him to come and be just witness, like be witnesses to his pain. Like, do you think that's part of the lesson that we should be taking from this week?
Absolutely. That there is a strength that can be gained from each other that can't be gained any other way. It's part of why we mourn with those who mourn, because there's a strength that comes from having someone just sit by you while you're in your mourning. And sometimes that's all you can do, and words make it worse, but just to be there, right? Or maybe I can just share a personal story that I hope doesn't make me seem wimpy, but I had a time where I was having to get blood drawn fairly regularly because of a tumor that I had. There was this one time where I must have been a little dehydrated. They were having a hard time getting blood out, and this nurse was really struggling, and she was had the needle in but couldn't get blood out. And she's reaching around and getting different stuff and moving that needle all around, and I just blacked out.
Oh no!
I've been there.
Yeah, I think my body, you know, that's the shock. Your body's programmed to say, okay, I'm bleeding. Yeah. I'm supposed to stop the bleeding, so I pull the blood away from there away from my brain to the heart to pull the blood.
Is
right?
that
so
what happens?
Out. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's your body's pre-programmed response to protect itself from dying, right? So I blacked out, and And I came to, but I was still in shock. It was really clear I was in shock and I couldn't kind of get myself to stand up or anything. And so I'm in this building that has doctors and stuff. And they take me to the doctor that had asked me to get the blood drawn. He's like, I can't do anything for him. Take me there. So they took me to the urgent care and they just can't get me to come out of shock. Like I'm fine. I'm talking to them. I'm aware, but I'm cold, clammy, can't stand up. They can't get me to. And so after like 40 minutes of them, like they're doing the smelling salts, they're doing all sorts of stuff. And my body's just like, no, that was dangerous. I'm staying in this hibernating state, right? Wow. I couldn't come out of shock. They finally called my wife and my wife came and I didn't know that, but my wife came and I heard her voice and she touched me. Shock's over.
Wow.
It was done. It was gone, right? It was just the power of someone that I loved, that cared about me, and that connection, immediately my body knew I'm okay. Wow. And I came out of shock. And I think that's the power of, we could call it the power of one to another, right? This connection that Christ was yearning for. So that's another part of his feeling alone, right? He brings his most staunch disciples. And I'm not discrediting them, and neither did Christ. He says, I know the spirit's willing and the flesh is weak. You've been up all night and it's a tough night and so on. Staunch disciples, the kind of guys who are going to pull out swords and try to defeat a whole, armed band that comes to take him. These are staunch guys, but when Christ is needing them and he's suffering and he turns to them for comfort and they're asleep, yeah. Right? Even then he's not getting the comfort. He's alone. Right? It's part of this aloneness that he's suffering to give us the opportunity to not be alone.
Yeah. And I'm sure in some even bigger way, it feels like, okay, he had that experience. So when that is your very individual experience, there's some oneness that's happening with just understanding that he lived through a very similar aloneness. Yes. that is really does kind of feel like a communion.
In fact, I feel very deeply that Christ experienced true, complete, real, full aloneness so that you and I never have to. We never will have to because he's there. And sometimes it's hard to feel him and to recognize that he's there, but I'm convinced that it would be worse if he wasn't there and hadn't done that. And that's, again, something that I'm overwhelmingly grateful for.
Yeah.
I'm curious. Beautiful. I mean, obviously there are lots of things in the mortal experience that sort of separate us from others that are maybe no fault of our own. Even just the example that you gave in relative race, some people, you know, grow up in the foster system and don't have the deep connection that other people that seem to have for whatever reason that we don't understand. But I think there's also a human tendency at times to inadvertently or, you know, potentially not inadvertently do things that separate ourselves from others.
Absolutely.
Have you thought much about this? I'm curious as you've gone through this, what has occurred to you as the things we humans tend to do most often that cause disconnection either with others or potentially with God?
There are a number of things. Some of it, I would say any amount of untruth tends to isolate us.
Yeah.
So when we're not honest with each other or even with ourselves or God, untruth isolates us.
I think that's right.
Anger, contention is an isolating factor. It just can't exist with communion. In fact, anything that drives the spirit away, because the spirit, and this is another thing I explore in the book, the unity that the spirit can bring, and you can get into some of the Greek terms there. I do that a little bit, and I think there's some powerful lessons in there, but the spirit is the great unifier. And that's what Christ teaches at the Last Supper, right? That I'm sending the spirit so that you can have this unity. Anything that drives the spirit away will isolate. I think there's also a human tendency, and in fact, it's a little bit like the shock I was just describing, right? So I do have a degree in psychology, so I get into these kinds of things, right? Human tendency when something is difficult, we call it the fight or flight or freeze syndrome, right? And sometimes we just freeze. We isolate. We curl up into that little fetal ball, even emotionally, even if we're not doing it physically. And I see this happen a lot of times. You know, we have a lot of people who are really struggling with depression and anxiety right now. It's a pandemic, I think. Mm-hmm. And the tendency when you feel the pain of anxiety or depression is to emotionally go fetal, right? Yeah. To emotionally curl up and isolate yourselves from others, which is so ironic because it's the very moment where you need someone else more than ever. It's so just counterproductive, but it's the natural impulse of the natural man in us, right? But the natural impulse when you feel sad, alone, or depressed or anxious to cut off yourself from your support, cut off yourself from everyone else, and be by yourself in a dark, lonely place. Yeah. It's the last thing you need.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about this kind of actually. I think, so you mentioned Jenna Erickson. I think this is from the same, I think this is from the same devotional. Mm-hmm. She quotes Llewellyn von Lee.
Yeah. It's a Muslim.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the quote is, it says, if we follow the path of any pain, any psychological wounding, it will lead us to this one primal pain, the pain of separation. And so I read it and it resonated, but also I was like, what does that look like in real life? What is following the path of a pain? I can see you justifying, okay, I'm going to stuff down anything that's uncomfortable because if I get into it, if I go down this rabbit hole, then it will lead me to more separation. So, but it feels like that's not at all what you're saying. Maybe even the opposite. So
right.
How do you metabolize pain in a way that is connecting instead of isolating?
That's a great question. And I mean, everyone has to deal with different things in different ways at different times, right? So there may be a time where you say, okay, I just can't talk about this right now. But staying there will lead to isolation, right?
Yeah.
So, but what I think he's saying when he talks about following the path of a pain is the path that causes that pain, right? So one of the other things that Janet talks about in that devotional is that she quotes someone she knows who's, I think, a therapist, but also a stake president. And he talks about how really all sin is the result. What we're doing with sin, when we sin, we are trying to deal with a pain or an unmet need, which is a pain. Yeah. Trying to deal either with an unmet need or a pain. We're just doing it in a way that actually causes pain. And so we're doing it in a way that causes isolation, right? Mm-hmm. Where so we distance ourselves from God or Christ and other people. Whereas if we do the other, think about repentance. Repentance is taking a pain from something you've done wrong and going to God with it rather than hiding and saying, this is what I did wrong. And this is painful and this is hard, and sharing it with him. And then he takes it away. That's not following the path of pain. That's following the path of unity, right? And it's the same thing if I've been deceiving someone or if I'm having contention with someone. If I follow that path, that's going to be further isolation, further pain.
Yes.
But if I'm seeking unity in the spirit, then we work those things out and we can mend it, right? And that's part of what you see again in relative races. Sometimes there have been some things that need to be worked out, but when you're willing to work it out, they can be mended.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's really beautiful.
I think the other part of that potentially too is that we tend to look at people, you know, through the eyes of judgment very often. And when we see, if we imagine another person as sinning out of, you know, their own weakness or villainy or whatever it is, then I think it can be easier to judge. If we see them as trying to meet some unmet need or unaddressed wound, then sort of, maybe it's not ironic, but like, I think counterintuitively, that actually prevents us from judging them and creates more connection between us and them. And obviously it happens both ways. We're obviously very often on the side of the sinner and not the onlooker.
So, and it's important for us to apply to ourselves and to other people when we're doing something that's wrong. And we know somewhere in the back of our mind it is, and we're trying to rationalize or something. That's a question we should ask ourselves. What's my unmet need? What's my pain that I'm trying to deal with? And what's the right way? What's the godly way to deal with this? And as you said, to ask it of someone else. Well, this person's doing this and it's hurting me, but why are they doing that? What's their unmet need? What's the godly way to help them deal with that?
Yeah, I think that's really helpful.
Okay, so we have to talk about the villain of the story, which is Judas.
Yeah.
what is there to learn from this part of the story?
You know, I don't get into like Judas's motives. I've thought about that lots of times. I can't figure out what his motives are, but there is something to learn from this part of the story. And that is that Christ himself has someone. So we've got the perfect teacher who perfectly loves, who has, I mean, there's no doubt he's done nothing wrong with Judas. Mm-hmm. He has taken him in and loved him in every way possible, and still Judas betrays him. So first of all, when we feel betrayed, and I think betrayal is one of the greatest pains we ever experience. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think Christ goes through some of the worst things, to be falsely accused when you're doing things right.
Oh, yeah, we have to talk about that too. Okay. But go ahead, we can finish Judas.
And to be betrayed by someone who you have done nothing wrong to and you've only tried to help. Those are painful things, and someone that you love, right? And that has loved you, and that you trusted. Those are painful things. And Judas does this. I'm not going to blame him or anything. Maybe he had to do it. I don't know what's going on there. Maybe he's thinking this won't really cause Christ harm. I have no idea. Yeah. But at least one of the functions it fills is that Christ in his, I mean, you think about the moment of the betrayal is just after incredible suffering. In fact, one of the things I try and touch on, it, not as much as I'd like to, but try and touch on in that, in the book, is this notion that I believe Christ has suffered, well, the scriptural phrase is more than mortal man can suffer except to be unto death. I believe mm-hmm. he has suffered so much that any other physical body would die, but because he has an immortal father, he can choose not to die. And you think about that. It's this is enough that bodies say, this pain is too much, I die. And he tells his body, no, you don't die, you keep suffering. That's incredible. But it's after that, where he has just suffered for Judas's sins, that Judas betrays him. And I think that, that hurdles him along this path of loneliness and isolation. But it's something that he had to experience to go down that path so that we could have it healed for us.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I feel like I've never thought about it in that way before. And not only was he coming out of sort of maximum suffering at that exact yeah. moment, he's also coming out of the moment of maximum empathy and yeah. understanding of yeah. Judas and his own woundedness and his own motives. Yes. And so, and if you extend this a little further, and we'll get, you know, more into this part of the story, but when he's actually asking for the forgiveness, for forgiveness for those who are crucifying him as he's on the cross, maybe part of that is coming from, again, coming out of the garden, having just experienced yeah. full empathy for whatever is going on with all of those wounded people who are inflicting that pain on him.
He knows what they're feeling. He knows what they're going through. Absolutely.
Yeah. yeah.
So you mentioned this so briefly, but I thought this was a really powerful part. And I hadn't looked at the story this way, but how the particular pain of being falsely accused when your heart's in the right place. And I know that feeling of like, you have very good intentions and to be accused when you've extended this effort and tried hard and be accused of the exact opposite of what your intentions were. That is a particular pain that I think is especially tricky because it brings up all of your own woundedness and insecurities and also just this disappointment of like, not only did it not work, but also yeah, it's still
isolating.
Taken for granted.
Yeah.
You feel very separated.
Yeah. yeah. You thought I was helping this person yeah. and they have done this. They're not who I thought I was. They're not who I thought they were. They don't understand who I am. Yeah. I can't trust them. They don't trust me. And suddenly you feel this separation or this yeah. this isolation yeah. that is particularly, it's ironically painful.
Yeah.
Right. And I
yeah.
remember always Elder Maxwell, who always said things so well, right? Mm-hmm. And him talking about that irony is the crust on the bread of adversity. And what you see
wow.
in all of what the Savior is going through is just irony after irony after irony, right? Yeah. Including just the whole model. That's one of the things that I kind of realized is, and I don't know, there were a number of things as I wrote this book and kind of put this lens on to write it, that I thought, oh, I've always known that, and yet somehow I didn't really realize that. And I never thought through the irony that in order for us to have a closer relationship with God, the first step was to be separated from him. Mm. And then you put the parallel irony on Christ, which is in order for Christ to make it possible for us to overcome our separation, he had to be separated. And I mean, there are just so many ironic elements in here that I think add to what Christ is going through.
Yeah. yeah. Do you want to pick up the story somewhere? I'm not sure where the best place would be, but I'd be curious, what are some of the most meaningful moments of separation now getting toward the actual end?
Yeah, I think probably for me, the two most meaningful moments are in Gethsemane. And, yeah. and we've talked about that a little bit, this aloneness. And Brigham Young suggests that even being separated from God there, that because that would make some sense, right? Part of the pain of sin is the loss of the Spirit and the loss of the companionship of the Holy Ghost and thus your connection with God. And so I'm sure he did separate that there. Although I think at the same time, he has an angel come to strengthen him. So he doesn't get to full and complete aloneness there, right? Yeah. But on the cross, that moment where he cries out, and to me, this is maybe the most haunting cry in all of the history of the world. And yet at the same time, it's our cry of triumph. But when he cries out, Eli, Eli, right? Which is E is my, and El is God. My God, my God. Lama, why? Sabachta, so have you forsaken me? So Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. Oh, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? When he suddenly finds himself apparently completely and fully alone in his most painful, most desperate moment, thinking that at least he had his father he could rely on, because he'd done nothing to deserve losing the father's presence. Mm-hmm. And yet he did anyway. And again, this unjustified suffering is that ironic crust, right? And I love Elder Holland has explored this in a number of places in a number of ways with beautiful language that only Elder Holland can use, right? As he talks about, to what corner of a universe does God flee to leave his son alone? And what is this like for Christ as he is alone? But I think that's probably the apex. And I don't know. I'm not the one who can declare or who know, but as I sift it through in my mind, it seems to me that's the apex of the atoning sacrifice. That's when he's experiencing everything, including that last bit on top of it, so that he is so, so alone in his towering, infinite suffering. And yet he goes through with it, so that at the end, he can say, you know, it is finished. And in the Joseph Smith translation, he says, it is finished, thy will is done, right? It's again, like, even when I was alone, I did your will. I did what you wanted to me, Father. Even abandoned, alone, rejected, I did what you wanted me to. And that's what made the atoning sacrifice happen, his determination to do his Father's will, even in those kinds of moments. And there's a lesson for us. And if we're not up to it, and probably none of us are, it's okay, because he was up to it, so he can make it so that we're up to it. And that's the beauty of the atoning sacrifice.
Thank you. That is really beautiful. And it made me think about, I remember very specific few years where I felt an aloneness. I felt like, even though I was trying to check every box and do all the things you're supposed to do, that it just felt like there was absolutely nothing that worked to make me feel the feeling of belief, to mm-hmm. feel like there was someone there. And I hadn't read the story that I know so well, I hadn't read the story with this lens that like, maybe this can still be everything going right. And in my mind, the way I was metabolizing that story was like, there's still something I'm not doing to earn God's presence, because it feels, I think there was part of me that felt very transactional. Like I should be able to do enough where God has to show up, because God's bound. And so if I can be obedient enough, I can earn presence. And it was just a really sweet reminder that there may be a bigger story going on. And sometimes that loneliness can be fulfilling a bigger purpose that will be totally invisible to us, because that's part of the process. This like not understanding why.
That's beautiful. And I think powerful. And to recognize that often we try and have a transactional relationship, which is not a real relationship, right? Our elder Christofferson puts it like thinking of a vending machine God, right? That if I do this, if I put this quarter in, then you will give me this, right? So it's interesting that you mentioned that, because after I wrote my first book on the covenant, God Will Prevail, I got, as I was going around the world speaking about covenants still, and some of the going around the world these days happens via Zoom. But anyway, I kept getting the same couple of questions, and I thought, oh, okay, I guess I didn't address those. So I wrote another small follow-up booklet on it, about finding the blessings that President Nelson asked us to find, but also about the covenant path. So as I was exploring, what does it really mean? How do I explain so that people really understand what it means to be on the covenant path? Because that's the question I was getting the most. Yeah. So what does it really mean to be on the covenant path? And I was trying, I was initially, and I still think this is valid, and I tried to explore it, but I was initially thinking, okay, well, you got to think through, okay, I've made this covenant, so what's my next covenant? Am I staying doing the things that keep me worthy of that covenant? And I think all of that was important, right? Mm-hmm. But I could sense that was too much of an emphasis on the checking the boxes kind of a thing, right? Yeah. And it suddenly occurred to me that the answer to that question was in my first book, which was, well, what's the covenant about? It's about relationship. That's why the first commandment is love God, and the second commandment is love your neighbor, because it's about relationship. So I suddenly realized, well, the best gauge as to whether you're on the covenant path or not is, do you love God? And if you love God, then all the other things happen because that's what you want, not because it's what you need to do, because you need to check off a box, but it's because it's what you want because you love God. In the same way that in a good marriage or a good parent, you're not doing these things for your child because someone made a list and said, this is what you need to do for your child. You're doing it because you love this child and you see their need and you're trying to meet their need and you're trying to help them, right? That's what the covenant path really is loving God. And so I think that speaks to what you were talking about. We may have times where we're not feeling God, but it's not because there's not a checklist. It's because this is how the relationship is working right now. And he's waiting for the right time or whatever else. There are a thousand reasons why. But we can know that he's experienced that aloneness. Well, his son has experienced that aloneness. And as a result, we know that sooner or later, whatever degree of aloneness we're feeling will be overcome and we will have complete full communion.
Yeah. I really like the point you brought up, Aubrey, about sort of like feeling separated for those years. Like it reminds me of Richard Rohr's The Wisdom Pattern, which he calls, and he sort of like says that he sees this over and over in our patterns of life where there's order and then disorder and reorder. I think there's also life and death and rebirth. And I think there's also union and separation and reunion. Mm-hmm. And we see that, you know, we see that in Jesus's life reflected very clearly here. And also I loved your comments about the covenant path. To be fully transparent, there have been times when that phrase repeated, you know, so often has rubbed me a little bit the wrong way because
I know lots of people are tired of it.
Yeah. I do hear it transactionally. Like it does seem very much like a checklist, and your sort of reorienting of this idea of the covenant as relationship gets me like back on board, you know, with this phrase. It's like, am I on the covenant path? Meaning, am I connected? Am I in relationship?
Yeah.
Like that's inspiring. So thanks for sharing that insight.
You're welcome. Yeah. As humans, we can pursue love all day, every day, right? We can be Captain America. I can do this all day, right?
Yeah.
I can't do checklists all day.
Yeah.
But love someone, I can do that all day.
Yeah.
Well, it's a really good reminder that when it is feeling exhausting or transactional, that's a good indication that we can shift how we're seeing how we're looking at the covenant path. Because I see the parent analogy is really good. Like that makes so much sense that someone could probably describe what a loving parent looks like. And if you put a checkbox in front of all of those things, that instantly becomes overwhelming and has sucked all of the soul and the love out of that actual relationship. But I understand that these are things that may happen if you are if you have this loving relationship with your child. But it feels like it's such a subtle and so important to just shift that and start from the love and then let it trickle down because I know there's something so overwhelming about trying to do it backwards.
Yeah. It's because it's impossible.
Yeah.
You can't do that. As I said,
and
you can't do that
work.
All day. Yeah. And it doesn't, you won't succeed in getting your need met the way you are, whatever, however you want to put it. Yeah. Right. And that's the lens. So this lens, the covenant relationship loving lens is the one that I was trying, you know, my hope was to see this in a different way. I was surprised at how apparent it was, how thoroughly intertwined it was, how much it's really the center and focus of this story. Yeah. And then I just thought, man, if I can help other people see this, and I wanted to do it in a quick, readable way, relatable way. My tendency, because I'm a scholar, was to do a 500-page book and really get into it. And I'll probably do that at some point for those who want that just to satisfy myself. But for this one, I was trying to get it into a quick, relatable, readable thing that someone could say, oh, this makes me love Easter. It makes me appreciate Easter and can overwhelm us with gratitude for Christ and God and the gift of sending Christ to us. That was my goal, that lens could be applied for everybody in that digestible of a way.
Yep. That's totally how it has functioned for us. And I think I've always felt like I feel like this whole around Easter, like I want more traditions that can make this feel like sacred time. Mm-hmm. And so this felt like a really quick way to access something that made this story feel even more holy because of the way it relates to my life immediately. So thank you, first of all. But also I want to ask you, like, are there ways that you can imagine that we can make this season feel sacred? You mentioned something about doing the Easter, the Palm Sunday walk, like something like that will help you to stay anchored to the most beautiful and most sacred parts of this story.
Yeah, I think that it's so important. And so what I think we can do, I don't know if you've heard of the concept of holy envy, where you can look at other religious traditions and kind of thing, right? So I have a degree of holy envy for people who really celebrate what we call the Passion Week or the Holy Week. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think we can do it and do it in a way that hopefully we can take the best of what they have, add the best of what we have, and really do something with it. So I do love taking Passion Week and doing something with it each day. Like I try and find readings that are meaningful mm-hmm. for us. As I've said, we've done the Palm Sunday walk. On my podcast, I did a little bit of this year. I'm doing even more so that each day of Passion Week, this year I've got Andrew Skinner, who's joining me. And so you'll be able to hear on the Scriptures Are Real. Each day we'll be releasing something like, here's some things you can think about for this day. Here's some things you can read. And then you have to find your own way of doing it. Like, is that for you going and serving someone? And I have some suggestions like, okay, this day you may want to go to the temple. This day you may, you know, cause Christ was going to the temple this way. He's talking about the what is mine. Maybe you want to go and serve someone and give some different things, that you can do to, make it meaningful to you. But I hope that we can take the full 8 days, right? Palm Sunday to Easter Sunday, that would give you 8 days. I hope we can take those full 8 days and focus on Christ like never before. I think that we'll really get something out of it. And I think we'll have like a different experience with the sacrament. And you can choose almost anything to read in there. You can go along and find the readings that are traditional with that, but you can, like, I supplement with Book of Mormon readings. Mm-hmm. But it's a wonderful time to focus on Christ. And I love to you know, hopefully people could read this book, but I love to read talks or other bookless things written by other people and just try and make it an immersive week as much as the week before Christmas. Yeah. We're so busy going and buying things and having family get-togethers and all this kind of a thing, right? Can we take all the energy that we put into Christmas presents, Christmas wrapping, Christmas dinners, mm-hmm. and put it in, let's still have get-together as a family and Easter dinners and that kind of a thing, but take all that time and energy that we would do at Christmas, right? Week before Christmas, a busy week. Yeah. Let's be that busy studying about Christ, praying, thinking, meditating, trying to serve others, going to the temple. And I think if we do that, we can have a fantastic experience drawing closer to the Savior and our Father through the Savior.
Yeah. Thank you.
I think Easter, it's an interesting opportunity to do that in contrast to Christmas, because there is so much cultural stuff that can be really fun and connecting in a lot of ways leading up to that holiday. It's less so with Easter. So it could be an opportunity for us to like focus a little bit more.
Yeah. Maybe we can. Christmas has become so commercialized, and I love Christmas and I love Christmas gifts and that kind of thing, but it has become so commercialized. Easter hasn't, besides buying candy, hasn't become quite as commercialized. So maybe we can take this bull by the horns and rest it, put it where we want it to be and say, this is what this is going to be like for me and my family.
Yeah, love that. Definitely. What could you, as we sort of start wrapping up, what can you tell us about the most beautiful, best part, I think, of this story, that after 3 days, so there's this separation that now the separation is more about who's left, everybody who's left and Christ is gone. And what do you learn from that separation and then this ultimate reunion after the resurrection?
It's a great question. And if I'd had more time, I would have explored it a little bit more in the book. I have a little bit in there, but I think of a couple of elements that kind of can illustrate what that is for us. So there, maybe I can just talk about three different things. One, when Christ says, it is finished, then he says, into thy hands I commend my spirit, mm-hmm. right? And we know he actually won't go to the Father right at that moment. But again, if I were to paraphrase that in my own words, I think he's saying, Father, I did it. Can I come home now? Can I be with you again? I did everything you asked. I just want to be home. I just want to be with you. That's such a beautiful sentiment, right? And then when I combine that with the joy that his apostles who have this horrible, they've watched him die, was not his disciples, I'll say, because I think key among this is Mary and some of the others, right? But who have watched him die, and in their minds, it's over. This is done. The gig's up. It didn't work out how we thought it would. And he is gone and gone forever. And then the joy, we can talk about Mary because she's the first one to think of the joy she must have felt when, like, Jesus, that's you. And the joy of that reunion is just a foreshadowing of the real joy with full reunion with our parents, right? But that's also when we're going to get him saying, and the translation of "Don't touch me," I think, is a bad translation. It's really "Don't keep holding on to me." So I think she's holding, she's hugging him and holding. Yeah. So it's a kind of a present ongoing verb. So it's "Don't keep holding on to me," I think, is the right translation. So I think that she's sitting there hugging him and holding on to him, and he's saying, "I can't stay here. You can't just hold me here forever. I have to go. I haven't yet been to my father, and I want to," right? "I want to be with my father." And that moment, the thought of when Christ got to be reunified with God, makes me so full of joy and hope, and makes me look forward so much to the day. I don't remember the way he remembers his father, but the day when we see our father, I think we will remember. And I think we don't understand the joy we will feel when we get to also run up to him and have that embrace and say, "Thanks for letting me come home." And then we can experience that even higher unity than we'd experienced before. This one of the things I say in the book, that just, it's a line that just keeps coming back to me again and again and again, that what Christ, his aloneness and his suffering and what he suffers, doesn't just make up the gap that has existed between us and our Father from the fall. It makes up the gap that existed before the fall. Where we will be capable of, and that's the whole purpose of the plan of salvation, the covenant, and Christ. We will be capable of a greater union and thus of a greater joy with our Father because of what Christ did. And that's a day that's worth looking forward to.
That's beautiful. Well, thank you so much. I feel like this has shaped the Easter story in a way that feels even more resonant. And so I think it will be part of our Easter tradition. So thank you so much for your contribution.
Thanks, Carrie.
Thank you. I hope so. That's all I wanted, was to help people during this season come closer to God through Christ.
Yeah, you can feel that. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. We really hope that you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Carrie Mulestein. You can find his book, The Easter Connection, at Siegel, Desert Book, and Amazon. And if Faith Matters content is resonating with you and you get the chance, we would love for you to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you listen on. We read all of the reviews, and it really helps us to get the word out about Faith Matters, and we appreciate the support. Thanks again for listening, and remember, you can check out more at faithmatters.org.